This Reformation audio resource is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. There is no copyright on this material, and we encourage you to reproduce it and pass it on to your friends. Many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog, containing classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at area code 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, T6L3T5. If you do not have a web connection, please request a free printed catalog. Letters on Baptism by Edmund B. Fairfield, as read by Samantha Ellosais. Tape 2. Letter 7. In your reply to my sixth letter, you say, quote, "If I remember correctly, a certain Baptist writer translates the passage to which you refer in the writings of the son of Sirach somewhat like this. If he who has dipped or immersed himself on account of a dead body shall again touch the corpse, what does his immersion avail? I would like to hear what you have to say to that." End of quote. First of all, I have to say that this translation is just like the certain Baptist writer to whom you refer. He begins with the assumption that because baptizo in the classic Greek means immerse, therefore it means immerse everywhere and always, and he makes everything bend to this theory. Were I to declare that baptizo in Jewish writings always means to sprinkle, I could prove it with less violence to the language of to the laws of language than the certain Baptist writer is perpetually committing in asserting dogmatically that it always means immerse. To take, for example, the case of Naaman at the Jordan, I could say that it was certain that the Syrian general sprinkled himself, for there could be no question that the person alluded to in Ecclesiasticus cleansed himself by sprinkling. True, the Hebrew states that Naaman dipped himself, but that is a mere figure of speech. He simply sprinkled himself, but he did it so copiously that he was just as wet as though he had dipped himself, and for that reason the Hebrew word tavel is used. And I could justify myself by quoting Milton, "The dew dips me all o'er." Dew comes down in mist, sprinkling one, but it may be so thorough a wetting as to be called a dipping. That sort of talk would be as reasonable as much as that certain Baptist writers. That is, it would be very unreasonable. But now, when I say that this word baptizo, meaning originally in classic Greek, to immerse, came by a very common process, illustrated in the history of a thousand words, to mean, in Jewish usage, to cleanse or purify, without reference to mode, I make a statement which does violence to no law of language. Here, in the history of Naaman, the Septuagint says that he baptized himself, that is, cleansed himself ceremonially, in the Jordan. The Hebrew says that he dipped himself. There is no contradiction. The Septuagint states the general fact of the cleansing. The Hebrew states the particular mode in which the cleansing was done on that occasion. All is reasonable. No violence is done to any principle of interpretation whatever. It is not necessary to assume, as some do, that the 70 intended to say the thing exactly as the Hebrew has said it. They often varied from the Hebrew in a similar way. Were two men who have traveled together from New York to Chicago to report their journey, the one might say, "We went by rail," the other might say, "We went by a Pullman." The reader, who should therefore insist that these two expressions were entirely synonymous, and that nobody could go by rail without taking a Pullman, would reason just as does the writer you quote on this subject. There is such a thing as a fair treatment of language. There is such a thing as an unfair treatment of it. doctor is sometimes very extravagant in his dogmatic statements. His exegesis is violent and unreasonable and fails to carry conviction to those who stop to examine. Let us look for a moment at his translation of the words of the son of Sirach. Quote, if one who has dipped or immersed himself on account of a dead body shall afterwards touch again the dead body, what shall his dipping or immersion avail him? End of quote. Is this a fair translation? It can be shown, I think, that it is very unfair. It is a translation that he would have never thought of, but for that unwarranted assumption of his as to the meaning of baptizo. He says, quote, this word means dip or immerse. It always means dip or immerse. It can't mean anything else. Everything must yield to this. End of quote. Did not the son of Sirach know the law of Moses to which he alludes in reference to ceremonial cleansing after one had touched a dead body? No one can question that. What was that law? I quoted it in my last letter. But let me refer to it again. It is very well worth our while to have it distinctly before us. This passage is the great battleground of this controversy. Turn to Numbers 19, verse 13, and you read, whosoever toucheth the dead body of any man, and purifieth not himself, that soul shall be cut off from Israel. Because the water of separation was not sprinkled upon him, he shall be unclean. That is the whole of it. Not because he was not immersed. There was no immersion about it. The 17th and 18th verses describe the whole process. They shall take the ashes of the burnt heifer, a purification of sin, and running water shall be put thereto in a vessel, and a clean person shall take hyssop and dip it in the water and sprinkle it upon him that touched the dead. The 19th verse goes on to give directions that this should be done by a clean person and should be done twice, on the third day and on the seventh. The only dipping was of the hyssop into the water. What right has doctor to translate, quote, if any person has dipped or immersed himself on account of a dead body, end of quote. Did not the son of Sirach know the law? He had seen it executed many a time, no doubt, and he says no such thing as the doctor has put into his mouth. What he says is, quote, if the man who has been baptized, that is, cleansed ceremonially, from a dead body, if he shall touch the dead body again, what does his cleansing avail him? End of quote. He said this knowing the whole process of baptism spoken of, knowing that the whole process of baptism spoken of was in the sprinkling of the water which had been put upon the ashes of the burnt heifer. If the water of separation had not been sprinkled upon him, he was unclean. If it had, he was cleansed. The doctor's translation is an unpardonable violence to the laws of human speech. When a man's theory compels him to such violence, he should conclude that his theory is wrong. After my study of this passage, I never could again assert that baptizo always meant immerse. Never. For here was a plain case, plain as day, where it was used in reference to a ceremonial cleansing that consisted wholly in sprinkling, and yet it was called baptism. And this was in a writing that was 200 years old when Christ was born. But this to which I have referred is not the only violence to language which the doctor's translation of this passage involves. The preposition apo means from, not on account of. To speak of being cleansed from a dead body makes good sense. To speak of being immersed from a dead body does not. So the doctor must translate apo on account of. This is, to say the least, strained and far-fetched. In one instance in a thousand, perhaps, it might possibly bear such a translation, but it is doubtful. Certainly no translation is given to it in the New Testament, although it is used about 400 times. Nor is this all. His translation of the last part of the sentence is not only without adequate foundation, it is absolutely against all the dictionaries and all the examples which I have been able to find. It is another illustration of the doctor's facility of assumption. Quote, what avails his dipping or immersion? End of quote. he renders it. The Greek word is lutro. Luo, the verb, is used 6 times in the Greek Testament and is always translated wash. The noun is used 2 times and in both cases translated washing. The translation that I have given to it expresses the idea perfectly. If he touched the dead body again, what avails his cleansing? The word often and more strictly means a bath, and this suggests the very interesting and pertinent question as to what was the ancient method of bathing. For as you know without any doubt, Baptist writers generally insist that bathing implies immersion. This is the doctor's assumption in his translation of this passage before us. It is a groundless assumption. I think whoever studies the subject thoroughly will find it true that in all Eastern bathing, in both ancient and modern times, it was regarded as a matter of chief importance that the water should be in motion. This was especially so among the Jews. The water applied to the ashes was to be running water, as seen from the quotation above in Numbers 19, verse 17. In the Hebrew, it is literally living water. See marginal rendering in Numbers 19, verse 17, Leviticus 14, verse 50, 51, and 52. This was the idea with the Greeks and Romans as illustrated by their baths, as described by Dr. William Smith in his Dictionary of Greek and Roman Antiquities. It would appear, he says, from the description of the bath administered to Ulysses in the palace of Circe, that the vessel did not contain water itself, but was only used for the bather to sit in while the water was poured over him. The water was heated in a large cauldron, under which the fire was placed, and when sufficiently warmed, was taken out in other vessels and poured over the head and shoulders of the person who sat in the bathtub. Dr. Smith further says, on ancient vases on which persons are represented bathing, we never find anything corresponding to a modern bath in which persons can stand or sit. But there is always a round or oval basin resting on a stand by the side of those who are of which those who are bathing are represented standing undressed and washing themselves. See Dr. Smith's dictionary, the article on baths. Confirmatory of this description given by Plutarch of bathing among the Greeks, in which he says, some give orders to throw the water on cold, others warm. See Wilson on Baptism, page 167. Wilkinson, on the manners and customs of the ancient Egyptians, speaks of a painting in an old tomb at Thebes, which represents a lady at the bath, in which one of her attendants is pouring water from a vase over her head. Volume 3, page 328. Travelers in the East find the same custom even when persons resort to a river for bathing. It is not for immersion, but for running water, which is thrown, poured, or sprinkled upon the bather. Water in motion seems everywhere to be sought for. There is still another criticism upon the doctor's translation of the passage from the son of Sirach. He translates, if he who has dipped or immersed himself, etc. The doctor could not have failed to know, had he thought but a moment, that the person who touched a dead body could not cleanse himself by any process whatever. The cleansing must be wrought by means of the sprinkling of the water of cleansing by another, that other being free from any taint of uncleanness. A clean person shall take hyssop and dip it in the water, and sprinkle it upon him that touched a bone, or one slain, or one dead, and the clean person shall sprinkle upon the unclean on the 3rd day and on the 7th day. Numbers 19, verse 18 and 19. The doctor's translation is every way Ari. The only fair translation is the one which I have quoted substantially from the common edition of the Apocrypha, sometimes bound up with our old version. Letter 8. As in your response to my last letter, you expressed yourself entirely satisfied with the force of the argument based upon the usage of baptizo in the Septuagint, we are prepared to go forward. The importance of this showing as to the accepted usage of the word at the time the New Testament was written cannot be overestimated. For thus it appears that this word was well understood among the Jews to mean just what I have claimed. It conveyed to those who heard Christ's teaching no other idea than that of ceremonial cleansing by water without regard to the mode of its application. This Greek translation of the sacred writings was the one with which they were more familiar than they were even with the Hebrew Bible. It is from the Septuagint that Christ and the apostles generally quote. True, the word is found only three times in the Septuagint, but that is enough to illustrate the usage. And it is interesting to notice that in one of these three, the baptism was by sprinkling, in one by immersion, and in the other certainly, or almost certainly, not by immersion and probably by pouring. But whatever the mode of applying the water, the word baptizo is used only in the general sense of ceremonial cleansing. Naaman baptized himself by immersion in the running Jordan. The man who had touched a dead body was baptized by sprinkling. Judith baptized herself at the fountain by sprinkling or pouring. The Jews were thus already accustomed and had been accustomed for 200 years or more to using this word in this sense. Does the meaning in the New Testament correspond with this usage? To this it might be answered, of course it must have corresponded to this, for the Septuagint constituted the basis of their language. But I do not propose to assume so much as this. On the contrary, if you will have the patience to follow me, I will refer to every passage in which the word occurs. It is most fitting to begin with that found in Hebrews 9, verse 10. You will see why. It is because the writer is referring to Jewish ordinances and customs, and these, of course, antedate those which are properly Christian. The writer to the Hebrews is discoursing on the ceremonial dispensation, which stood only in meats and drinks and diverse baptisms. Greek, baptismois. In my review of the position which I had so long and so honestly occupied, as I have spoken of it in my first letter, I said to myself when I came to this verse, here I shall find my Baptist views well sustained. There are plenty of immersions laid down in the ceremonial law to justify the writer of this epistle in thinking of them as diverse baptisms. Accordingly, I set myself to making an array of them. If you had not gone through with this or some similar experiment, you will scarcely be prepared to appreciate my astonishment at not being able to find one. Purifyings there were, diverse of them, but immersions, not one. Of course, my method was to take my Hebrew concordance and trace all the passages in which tabel was used in the Old Testament in setting forth the things required of the worshipper. As I have previously stated, I found that the word was used only 16 times in all, and the only instance that approached a ceremonial usage, such as this verse speaks of, was Naaman's dipping or immersing himself in the Jordan. And in that case, I found that he was not commanded to dip or immerse himself, but to cleanse himself. He chose to do it by immersion, and as the method of cleansing was not specified, it was proper for him to choose his own. I have not succeeded thus far in finding one instance in which anybody was required to dip or immerse himself, or to be dipped or immersed by another, from the beginning of Genesis to the end of Malachi. And yet the Epistle to the Hebrews speaks of this Old Testament dispensation as embracing diverse baptisms. You can readily believe that my previous notion that baptism always meant immersion received at this point another staggering blow. Diverse baptisms? Not one immersion is the way the case stands. The Hebrews to whom this epistle was written understood the matter. Long before this, the word baptism had come to mean ceremonial water cleansing and not immersion in all the sacred writings. Shall we find that it never means anything else except in a figurative sense? We shall see. For the present, we must confine our thoughts to this passage and must agree, I think, that upon the assumption that baptism meant ceremonial water cleansing, everything is clear. But assume for a moment that it meant immersion, and everything is dark. More than that, what the writer to the Hebrews says is impossible to be understood at all upon that assumption. To this may be added the evidence from the context which plainly indicates that the reference is to the purifyings under the law and not to immersions, even had there been any. But the writer goes on to say, if the blood of bulls and of goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean sanctify us to the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? Hebrews 9, verse 13 and 14. The ceremonial purifyings of the Old Testament dispensation, contrasted with the spiritual cleansing wrought through the blood of Christ, is the obvious scope of the entire passage. Our translation uses the word washings, where it is baptismois in the Greek. But the word purifyings or cleansings would be preferable, for it appears from the passage itself that the writer has in mind the purifyings that were by sprinkling, that word being introduced no less than 3 times within 9 verses. Read at your leisure the whole chapter, and you will see that I am not mistaken in my interpretation of it. I think that I do not speak too strongly when I say the diverse immersions is an utterly impossible version of the words which are so rendered by the Baptist Union. Mark 7, verse 2 to 4. An allusion to Jewish customs comes next in order is that found in the first part of the 7th chapter of Mark. I quote the verses. There are gathered together unto him the Pharisees and certain of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem, and had seen that some of the disciples ate their bread with defiled, that is, with unwashed hands. For the Pharisees and all the Jews, except they wash their hands with the fist, eat not, holding the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the market, except they baptize themselves, they eat not. And many other things there be which they have received to hold, as the baptizings of cups and pots and brazen vessels and tables. This is a very interesting passage. I have given it my own translation, which I will proceed to explain and defend. The word pygmy I have translated literally, with the fist. In the old version, it is translated oft. In the new version, diligently. I think that there is more light upon this point than has generally been seen hitherto, and after thorough study of the matter, I have been entirely clear that the rendering which I have given it, suggested by M.C. Hazard in The Congregationalist, is the true one. But to that will I come again presently. The first thing I wish to call to your attention, is the practice to which allusion is here made of baptizing themselves whenever they returned from the market. That this was immersion is incredible. Everybody in the East goes off into the marketplace. It is a large open square and is the great public resort. It would require, with many, several immersions a day. Even bathing, as we have seen, was not performed by immersion, and this baptizing of which Mark speaks was obviously for ceremonial cleansing. The people had always known that even after having touched a dead body, the baptizing was by sprinkling. The ceremonial cleansing from the leprosy was by sprinkling. The priest shall sprinkle upon him that is to be cleansed from leprosy 7 times. Leviticus 14, verse 7. At the public market, one might have unknowingly touched some leper, or some unclean beast, or someone who was unclean from having touched a dead body. And it was not an unnatural thing that he should conclude that it was a proper precaution to cleanse himself upon his return home. And the first thing he would think of was to do it by sprinkling. He would never think of doing it by immersion, there not being a single requirement for immersion in the whole Mosaic Code. Moreover, it must be by water in motion. Running water, living water, was always prescribed. See Leviticus 14, verse 5, 6, 51, and 52, as well as 15, verse 13, and Numbers 19, verse 17. This is a most important point to be noticed, and I beg of you to read the passages which I have indicated so as to fix that point in mind thoroughly. As we have already seen, no bathing tub for immersion was ever used. When such a tub was used in connection with the bathing of the whole person, the bather used it simply for a receptacle of the water after it had been sprinkled or poured upon the body. The water was then defiled and unfit for further use. The method of washing the hands at the present day, as I have found it in Syria and in Turkey, is very suggestive of what there is every reason to believe was the custom in all Bible lands and Bible times. If you enter a house, the servant appears with a washbowl and pitcher, but you are never expected to pour water into the bowl and wash, as our habit is. The empty bowl is put in a place convenient for you to hold your hands over it. The attendant then pours the water on your hands, and you wash them with soap or without, and the dirty water falls into the bowl. It would shock every Oriental idea were you to dip your hands into the bowl, unless you were without any possible means of doing otherwise. The water poured from the pitcher becomes running water, and your hands are cleansed in that way. And now we are prepared to understand that clause about washing with the fist. Many times there is no servant in attendance to pour the water or to sprinkle it upon the Oriental traveler or upon this man who comes home after contact with something or somebody unclean. He must himself, therefore, perform the whole ceremony. How does he do it? He lays hold upon the pitcher himself and with one hand, and pours the water upon the other, and in turn takes the pitcher in the other hand and pours the water upon the first. So they are both cleansed in the running water. I quote here the words of Mr. Hazard, to which I referred a little while ago. Quote, "It was a feeling that the real explanation of this passage had not yet been reached that led me several years ago to take the passage to a noted Jewish rabbi for interpretation. He read it in the Greek and then contemptuously said, 'It is evident that Mark did not know what he was talking about.' Catching my breath at such an easy disposing of the matter and of the author of the second gospel, I approached the subject from a new direction. I asked the rabbi whether it is true that now the Pharisees do not eat, except as they first baptize their hands. He replied in the affirmative, and on my request for more information said, 'But we do not baptize them as you do, in a quiet pool, but in running water, either in a natural stream, or in the water flowing from a hydrant, or in water poured from some vessel by main strength from one hand upon the other.' The expression 'by main strength' immediately caught my attention, and I said to him, 'Rabbi, I thought that you said that Mark did not know what he was writing about. When he says from the fist, doesn't he mean exactly what you have now said? Ordinarily, it would have been impossible in Mark's day for anyone to have baptized his hands at home in running water, except as he poured it out of some pitcher or basin from the fist upon the other hand.' The rabbi thought for a moment, and then, with a candor which much commended this modern Pharisee, said, 'I was wrong. That was what Mark did mean.' Mr. Hazard then goes on to say, quote, 'The rabbi had awakened my curiosity in saying that the Jews never baptized their hands except in running water, and I asked him for the reason of that. His reply was that still water represents death and corruption, and running water life and the quickening influences of God's Spirit. In any of their ceremonial lavations, I inquired, do the Jews lay any emphasis upon the amount of water in which they baptize? None. The tiniest stream of water would suffice for his most complete ceremonial lavation.'" End of quote. There is also another practice which the modern traveler has frequent occasion to observe, which may have prevailed in New Testament times, and to which reference may have been made in this passage. Sometimes there is no vessel which the man can lift, even by main strength, and in that case he takes up a fistful of water, say in his right hand, and pours it or sprinkles it upon the left. The left is thus cleansed. But although the right hand has gone into the water, it is not yet cleansed, for it went only into the stagnant water. The left fist, in like manner, is used to cleanse the right hand by water set in motion. So thoroughly is the mind possessed of the idea that it must be water in motion in order to effect the cleansing. One who sees day after day this process constantly gone through with can easily believe that it might have been this which was referred to by Mark. This word, pygmy, has always been a troublesome one to the translator and to the commentator. It is found only once in the New Testament, and hence there is no opportunity for comparing different passages in which it is used. But it is thoroughly confirmatory of this interpretation to notice that this same word is used twice in the Septuagint, and in both cases it is unhesitatingly to be translated with the fist and nothing else. If men strive together and one smite another with a stone or with his fist, and he die not but keepeth his bed, etc. Exodus 21 verse 18. Also, behold ye fast for strife and debate, and to smite with the fist of wickedness. Isaiah 58 verse 4. It is therefore almost certain to my mind that this is the only proper translation here, and it renders a very obscure passage entirely intelligible. It may also be added that it would be difficult, if not impossible, to find any authority in classic Greek for the translation given, either in the Old or the New Version. I have never seen quoted in any Greek lexicon a single passage in which the word is supposed to mean either oft or diligently. Liddell and Scott refer only to the passage in Mark as one in regard to which they do not commit themselves, but only say that, quote, it is interpreted by some to mean diligently and by others oft, end of quote. Professor Thayer, in his lexicon of the New Testament, seems decidedly to accept the translation which is here advocated, although he makes a different comment upon it. Footnote. Pugmi niptiste tes shiras, to wash the hands with the fist, that is, so that one hand is rubbed with the clenched fist of the other. Translating with the fist, each reader can decide for himself which of the two explanations is more natural. With the Eastern custom in mind, as it is seen everywhere, it is easy for me to decide. For Professor Thayer's comment is just as consistent with our fashion of washing as with theirs, and does not imply that the water is in motion at all, which with them is the main thing. I have often seen the ceremonial cleansing of very dirty hands without the slightest attempt at any rubbing. In truth, the hands were just as dirty after the cleansing after before, but they had sprinkled the water very vigorously. In this same passage is a reference to the baptism of tables, and according to some of the manuscripts, of couches. I am aware that the most approved manuscripts do not contain either of these words, but the fact that these readings are among the oldest shows that they were accepted for centuries, and they never would have been introduced had there been any supposed impossibility in baptizing tables and couches. Their immersion was a manifest impossibility. Let anyone visit the old city of Pompeii, buried up in A.D. 70, and see the uniform construction of their tables, occupying three sides of a hollow square, stationary, incapable of immersion, and all doubt on that subject will be at once removed. They were baptized, if at all, by sprinkling, beyond any reasonable question. Baptizo had long before that come to express the idea of ceremonial purification. Such ceremonial purification was never once required to be by immersion. It was in many instances commanded to be by sprinkling, and hence it is the most natural conclusion possible that they never dreamed of baptizing tables and couches by dipping them. In Luke 11, verse 38, is another passage showing the use of the word baptism among the Jews. A Pharisee had invited Jesus to dine with him, and he went in and sat down to meat. And when the Pharisee saw it, he marveled that he had not first baptized himself before eating. It is very hard to believe that Christ was expected to immerse himself before eating. This is evidently the same sort of thing that is spoken of in the passage which we have just been considering. Christ had been mingling with the multitude. It was the need of the ceremonial cleansing in the ordinary way which they had in mind. That was by sprinkling. There is no proof that their houses were constructed with accommodations for immersion of all their guests. The proof is on the other side. In the account of the marriage at Cana of Galilee, we have the thing so described as to make it visible. There were set 12 firkins after the manner of the Jews purifying. From this water the guests drew off and sprinkled themselves, or the servants poured it upon them. The water was so used that it was entirely fit for drinking purposes. Not even the hands of the guests were put into it. It was for something very different from immersion. Next in chronological order comes the use of this word in describing John's baptism, and I begin by saying that even if it could be proved that immersion was sometimes practiced in the New Testament times, nay, if it could be proved that it was always practiced, that would not settle the question that immersion was required. That is to be determined only by the meaning of the word. What does the law of Christ require is the only question that vitally concerns us. Christ and his apostles sat while they preached. We are commanded to preach, but we are not commanded to sit while we preach. Christ and his apostles always traveled either on foot or on horseback, or in boats when they went on their preaching tours. We are commanded to go into all the world with the gospel, but we are not commanded to go in the same way they went. Christ and his apostles celebrated the Lord's Supper, reclining at the table. This is the only meaning of the word used in the Greek, although our translators have rendered it by our word sit. We are commanded to eat and drink, but we are not commanded to do it reclining. They went about doing good, wearing sandals and loose flowing togas. We are required to go about doing good, but we are not confined to their manner of doing it. As to the meaning of the words baptize and baptism, we have found that they were sometimes, to say the least, used of ceremonial cleansing, which was performed without immersion. That the writer to the Hebrews refers the old dispensation as requiring of the worshipper diverse baptisms, while in the Old Testament, immersion is never once required. This settles the question that the law of baptism does not require immersion, and the particular manner, therefore, in which John and the apostles baptized is as immaterial to us as their manner of dressing, their methods of missionary travel, or their positions at the Lord's table. I say thus much because we ought always to make this discrimination between what the apostles did and what we are required to do. They had all things common, and it has been sometimes argued that their example is a law to us. This is a mistake. Their example is not at all binding upon us, any farther than it can be shown that it was in accordance with the commands of the Master. I do not speak of this because I think that, as a matter of fact, John the Baptist and the apostles baptized by immersion as a general thing. I do not think that they did. In some cases, it is certain to my mind that they did not. In none is it certain that they did. But even if they did, it imposes no obligation on us. With this preliminary statement, we can come to the study of the history with a proper appreciation of the weight of the argument, whatever it may be. First in order comes the record of John's baptism. It is argued that this was by immersion on two grounds. First, the baptism is said to be in the River Jordan. This proves nothing. For one, it was so distinctly impressed upon every Jew that ceremonial cleansing, which we have already shown was expressed by the word baptism, must always be by running water, or, as it is in the Hebrew, living water, that we can readily understand how much pains would be taken to reach it. Two, the preposition which is here translated in is very frequently rendered at. You will hear it said that only epi means at, and that en means in. But this is so far from being an invariable rule that anyone who will be at the trouble of looking the matter up will find that epi is found only 44 times in the Greek, where we have in our version the rendering at, over against 102 times in which at is a translation of en. Number three, the expression in the River Jordan applies to the whole riverbed, which is often, I may more truly say almost always, much wider than the stream. Travelers speak of pitching their tents in the Jordan, in the River Jordan, meaning within the outer banks, of course, not in the water. Second, the account states that Jesus, after his baptism, went up out of the water. This implies his immersion. I reply, number one, out of the water is admitted by all competent critics not to be an exact translation. No Baptist scholar would be willing to risk his reputation upon such a rendering of the preposition apo. In the Revised Version, it is translated from, and never should have been translated otherwise. Number two, assuming that John used a bunch of hyssop and performed the baptism according to the old law, dipping it into the running water and sprinkling those who came to his baptism, everything told us of John's baptism at the Jordan would apply. There is not one circumstance, nor one detail, that would need to be changed. Letter 9. In response to my last, you say, quote, how do you get along with the version of the Baptist Union in which they translate Matthew 3:11, I indeed immerse you in water? Is not the preposition en used here, and are they not justified in saying in water? I would prefer to retain the word baptized, but why not translate, I indeed baptize you in water? End of quote. You put the matter very well, and I will endeavor to make my answer plain to one who has not studied the Greek as well as to one who has. Let me say, then, three things. First, the preposition en often means with. It is so translated in our common version more than 100 times. Take one verse as a sample to illustrate its use in expressing, as the grammar says, the manner, means, or instrument. It is found in 1 Corinthians 5, verse 8. Let us keep the feast not with old leaven, neither with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Three times in this verse, en is translated with. No English scholar, I think, would translate it in any other way. Number two, that this is the proper translation whenever it is used in referring to water baptism is made clear from the fact that in 3 out of 8 cases in which water baptizing is spoken of, there is no preposition at all. For example, in Matthew 3, verse 11, John is represented as saying, Ego baptizo humus in hudati, while in Luke 3:16, the same statement of John is in these words, Ego baptizo humus hudati. In this last form, hudati can be nothing else but the dative of means, or instrument. I baptize you with water is the obvious and only translation. Hence, the parallel passage in Matthew must naturally be translated in the same way. In other words, the case stands thus. Luke's version of what John says can only mean with water. Matthew's version, taken by itself, could be translated either with water or in water. The former makes the two accounts to harmonize completely and is therefore to be preferred. Thirdly, you will see also that it is too plain for contradiction that, as no one would ever think of saying, I immerse you with water, immerse is not the proper translation of baptize in Luke 3, verse 16. And if not in this verse, then it is not in the parallel verse in Matthew 3, verse 11. But we wish to study this passage, which speaks of John's baptism, a little more thoroughly, to see whether the definition of baptize as expressing the idea of ceremonial cleansing does not entirely fit the whole connection far better than the theory that it means immerse. Here is the passage in full. I indeed baptize you with water, but he that cometh after me is mightier than I, whose shoes I am not worthy to bear. He shall baptize you with the Holy Spirit and with fire. Understanding the word baptize to express purification or cleansing, everything is plain. John's cleansing was by water. Christ should be by the Spirit and by fire. An evident advance in thought, which is entirely natural, purification running through the whole. And, as if to make it still plainer, the very next clause reads, Whose fan is in his hand, and he will thoroughly purge his floor and gather his wheat into the garner, but he will burn up the chaff with unquenchable fire. John the Baptist was not John the Immerser, but John the Purifier. He was recognized, I take it, as a sort of stern, rigid, uncompromising Puritan. The people came to his baptism confessing their sins. he preaches plain truth, tells them of one yet to be revealed, who will purify them more thoroughly by far. They would naturally think of the prophecy 400 years before. Behold, I will send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way before me, and the Lord whom ye seek shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant whom ye delight in. Behold, he shall come, saith the Lord of hosts. But who may abide the day of his coming, and who shall stand when he appeareth? For he is like a refiner's fire, and like fuller's soap, and he shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. He shall purify the sons of Levi, and purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness. These prophecies, referring to the coming of Christ, and particularly to his forerunner, might naturally lead them to expect someone who should come as a purifier, and they would recognize John as fulfilling the prophecy. Hence that question of the priests and Levites who were sent to John to find out who he was. He was not Elias, nor the prophet, nor the Christ, nor a prophet. Why baptizest thou then, if thou be not the Christ, nor Elias, neither that prophet? I know of no prophecy foretelling that either Christ or his messenger should immerse anybody, but various prophecies spoke of them as purifiers. For example, then will I sprinkle clean water upon you, and ye shall be clean. So shall he sprinkle many nations. I understand these prophecies to foretell, in figurative language, that Christ should come to purify. For ceremonial purification was so often by sprinkling, so generally by sprinkling, that the figure would be readily understood. And so the writer to the Hebrews speaks of having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience. If it be asked just where, why sprinkle was not used in the commission instead of baptize, if ceremonial cleansing was to be expressed, it may be answered that sprinkling was sometimes of blood, sometimes of ashes, not always of water. Christ wished to employ water henceforward as the only emblem of purification, and so he chose another word, already in well-established usage, a word that had been for centuries used to express the idea of ceremonial cleansing by water, and whose original signification would suggest the thoroughness and completeness of the cleansing that was to be wrought. Understanding baptism to express this general idea, all is plain. Understanding it to mean dip, plunge, or immerse, everything is awkward and obscure. Take another passage. After these things came Jesus and his disciples into the land of Judea, and there he tarried with them and baptized. And John also was baptizing in Aenon, near to Salim, because there was much water there, and they came and were baptized. Then there arose a question between some of John's disciples and the Jews about purifying. And they came unto John and said unto him, Rabbi, he that was with thee beyond Jordan, to whom thou bearest witness, behold, the same baptizeth, and all men come to him. This whole narrative indicates the close relationship between the two words, baptize and purify. Two views may be taken of it, either that the two terms are used interchangeably, as substantially synonymous, or that, without being synonymous, the baptizing which was understood to symbolize purity led to a discussion about purifying in general. Either view is inconsistent with the theory that regards baptism as a symbol of death and resurrection, for in that case, while the ordinance might have led to a general discussion of that topic, it is not easy to see how purifying could have become the subject of dispute at all. But I think that more than this is demanded by the exegesis of this passage. Two parties baptizing, a controversy as to whether they both had an equal right to do so. The settlement of that controversy by John telling them that Christ had as good a right to baptize as he, and even a better right, that I can understand. Such a paraphrase makes the whole case clear, but this supposes baptizing and purifying to be employed as substantially synonymous terms. And this, I cannot help thinking, is the true interpretation. But could not a general discussion on purification grow out of baptism, it is asked, without supposing the two things to be the same? Most certainly. But what has their statement of the case when they come to John to do with a general discussion of that sort? Nothing. The nature of the dispute is not specifically stated and can only be inferred from what precedes and from what follows. The antecedent fact stated is that both Jesus and John were baptizing near together. The natural inference is that the dispute was as to the apparently conflicting claims of the two, and this inference becomes irresistible when we discover that this was the only question which they brought to John, and the only one to which he makes the slightest allusion in his reply. If they did have a discussion on the general subject of purification, their statement of the case to John is quite unaccountable, and his reply still more so. Read over the whole narrative as it is recorded in John 3, verse 22 to 36, and you will see plainly that the facts are, first, both Jesus and John were baptizing in Aenon. Second, there arose a question about purifying. Third, some persons went to John to tell him that Jesus was baptizing, and they evidently had a feeling that he ought not to be doing it. Fourth, John assures them of Christ's supremacy in all things. That is the whole story, and I am constrained to believe that there was but one subject suggested by these verses, which in one place is called baptizing, in another purifying, the two words being used interchangeably as though substantially synonymous. What do the Baptist critics say to this? Dr. Carson replies in substance, quote, "It is none of our business to explain the connection. The historian states that they were immersing, and purification and immersion we know are not the same. Purify is a general term, baptize is not." End of quote. If this style of argument is not what logicians call a begging of the question, we confess that we do not know what would be. But does not the historian say that John was baptizing at Aenon because there was much water there? And does not that indicate immersion as a method of his baptism? I answer. 1. Every scholar knows that the word Aenon means fountains or springs. The springs are still there as they were 2,000 years ago. 2. Anyone who knows even a very little Greek can discover that the words translated much water are in the plural and literally translated would read many waters. 3. Even a Baptist minister would need neither a great body of water nor many springs, even for purposes of immersion. Hence, an allusion to either much water or many waters is not at all necessary to explain the simple fact of baptism, whatever the method of it may have been. 4. For some other reason, therefore, than baptism did John choose this location, and it is not difficult to find a reason far more satisfactory. Immense throngs of people waited on the ministry of this mighty preacher. Many of them came from afar. It was, so to speak, a great camp meeting that was held at Aenon. The many springs would be in requisition for accommodating both man and beast. 5. John never baptized except where there was running water. He would have revolted from the thought of a baptistry. It must be living water, hence the Jordan. But one of the living springs at Aenon might have answered his purpose, no matter what his manner of baptizing. For myself, I am of the opinion that all his Jewish education would lead him to dip a bunch of hyssop in the running water and sprinkle it upon the people in token of their turning away from their sins unto the living God. The words of the psalmist were familiar to him. "Pure me with hyssop, and I shall be clean." It was so often by sprinkling of the hyssop that cleansing came under the law. He had read the prophecy, "I will sprinkle clean water upon you, and ye shall be clean." He had often heard that other prophecy, "So shall he sprinkle many nations." And although he knew full well, as his preaching shows, that he did not understand any outward ceremony as having in itself saving or cleansing power, yet when an outward ceremony symbolizing inward cleansing was to be used, he would most naturally employ the ceremony which from time immemorial had been used to express it. Letter 10. In your reply to my last, you say, quote, "Your discussion of the baptism at Aenon is quite satisfactory to me on the whole, but there is one point upon which I would like to have a little more light. It is this. Some of the Baptist writers tell me that pola hudata means more properly much water in a body than many fountains, and they quote some examples to illustrate that use of it. What answer would you make to that?" End of quote. To this I reply, first, there is not at the present time any body of water at Aenon, nor any indication that there ever has been in historic times such as a body, but there are plenty of springs. Second, admitting that pola hudata may be used in speaking of a body of water and be rendered in a general way much water, it is altogether likely that the conception of the writer would be quite as well expressed by rendering the words many waters as they are in Revelation 1, verse 15, and 19, verse 6. Third, that the expression may be used in speaking of a number of fountains is entirely clear from the passage in 2 Chronicles 32, verse 3 and 4. The passage reads thus, "He, Hezekiah, took counsel with his princes and his mighty men to stop the waters of the fountains which were without the city, and they did help him. So there was gathered much people together who stopped all the fountains and the brook that ran through the midst of the land, saying, Why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water?" In the Greek Septuagint, the words are pola hudata, which seems evidently to refer to these fountains and the brook, no body of water being spoken of. I come now to speak of the baptism of the 3,000 on the day of Pentecost. This is easily understood upon the theory that the word baptizo was understood to mean what I have proved it to mean at the time of Christ's coming and before. It is an account not easy to be understood upon the Baptist assumption that the word baptize means always immerse. This was a large number to be immersed, as all admit. Many of them were strangers who had come to the feast, Parthians and Medes and Elamites, and all the rest whose nationality is mentioned in the Acts. It is not at all likely that they would be prepared with convenient changes of raiment for immersion, and still less likely that they were immersed in a state of nudity. Such indelicacy and superstition had not developed themselves at that day. And then consider the circumstances. They were at Jerusalem. There is no natural body of water there or near there. The brook Kedron is ordinarily an almost dry watercourse, unless the seasons were entirely different then from what they are now, of which there is no proof and no probability. There would have been only a little rill of water at about the time of Pentecost. There were therefore no facilities about Jerusalem for immersion, except in the reservoirs of water used for drinking and cooking. To conceive of the apostles baptizing in these is preposterous. Forbidden by common decency, it would have been especially forbidden by the violent and unyielding superstition of the Jews, even had they been favorably inclined toward the apostles and their religion. But it would have been especially forbidden by the deadly hostility to the new faith which then prevailed. They would not have allowed their best friends to be immersed in these pools. And the disciples of that Christ, whom they had just crucified, would by all means have been prevented from propagating their religion in the use of any body of water under their control. I have studied this subject in Jerusalem, and I cannot see how anyone familiar with the topography of the city, and considering the times of violent persecution which ere long scattered the church to the ends of the earth, ran for a moment, except with any assurance the belief that the 3,000 were immersed on the day of Pentecost, there being no natural body of water to furnish facilities and no artificial reservoirs to which access would not have been utterly impossible. And then the baptism of the jailer. It has always been difficult for the Baptist theory to provide for that baptism. Their sole dependence is upon the word baptizo. That means nothing but immersed. And the historian says that the jailer was immersed. deny it if you dare. It is none of our business to find the baptistry. This is our Baptist scholar's method of disposing of the matter. But we have already proved beyond all successful contradiction that in the Septuagint and in the New Testament usage, the word baptizo is used to express ceremonial purification by water without reference to mode and in cases where immersion is entirely out of the question, so that the whole foundation of such an assumption is entirely gone. We understand baptism, then, to be a ceremony of cleansing and consecration to a holy service. This makes the formula of baptism plain. I baptize thee in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Better translated, to the name, etc. The preposition is is, which is translated to about 500 times in the New Testament. We are thus set apart to the service of God, and thus we consecrate our children. The passage in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 2 becomes easy of interpretation. They were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. Baptist writers are zealous to find immersion here, and so they suppose that the sea being on their two sides, the cloud must have been above them. Thus they were enveloped. This is mere theory. And the unfortunate thing about it is that the history states that the cloud was behind them and not above them. Certainly it was not also before them. On the other hand, I have heard a zealous paedo-baptist suggest that the spray of the sea probably sprinkled them and thus they were baptized. It is more sensible to find here no reference whatever to the act of baptism, but to the understood significance of it as an act of consecration expressive of our faith in Him to whom we are thus consecrated. As in our baptism we are set apart to the service of God, promising obedience and fidelity, so were the children of Israel set apart to follow Moses as their divinely appointed leader. In the cloud which protected them, and in the sea which opened to allow their passage, was the evidence of His divine appointment. And in these manifestations they saw that it was safe to follow Him. So were they baptized unto Him. Before closing this letter, I wish to call your attention to another point, which seems to me to fall in most happily with the idea of cleansing as conveyed by the word baptize. It is this, that this view of the matter accords with the true conception of the substantial unity of the two dispensations. It is not necessary that we should go into the matter very largely to argue the substantial oneness of the Church from the beginning. There has been but one plan of salvation, but one way of pardon, but one system of truth, but one Christ from Abraham down. Christ said, "I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill." Old Testament and New Testament make together one Bible. The coming of Christ is the common center of both. Abraham was saved by Christ as really as those to whom Peter preached at the Pentecost. Under the old dispensation, there were two ordinances, circumcision and the Passover. Under the new dispensation, there are two, baptism and the Lord's Supper. The two great doctrines of both dispensations are the same, justification and sanctification, forgiveness and holiness, pardon and purity. Standing at the middle point, the great center of all the centuries, the cross of Christ, we see it written, "Without the shedding of blood there is no remission of sins." The Passover was the feast commemorative of deliverance by the blood of sprinkling. The Lord's Supper shows forth the Lord's death till the end of time and commemorates our deliverance by the blood of sprinkling. Both speak of pardon. Circumcision symbolized purity, the putting away of the filthiness of the flesh and spirit. Many passages so represent. Circumcise therefore the foreskin of your heart. He is not a Jew which is one outwardly, neither is that circumcision which is outward in the flesh. But he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, and not in the letter. We are the circumcision who worship God in the spirit. Now, if baptism under the New Testament dispensation is also ceremonial cleansing, the unity is complete. But if it is burial and not purification, the unity is broken. I present this argument not as conclusive in itself, but as strongly presumptive in favor of the view which has been presented, and as confirmatory of the unequivocal proofs already submitted, showing that baptism means cleansing and not immersion. The unity is not broken. If you will be kind enough to call to my attention in your next letter to any points upon which you would wish to have more light, or to any difficulties which you may find in accepting the general teaching of these letters, I will be better able to present just the things which are necessary to clear up all the difficulties in the case. Truth is always in harmony with itself, and whenever one comes to occupy the right standpoint, this harmony appears. This Reformation audio resource is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. There is no copyright on this material, and we encourage you to reproduce it and pass it on to your friends. Many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog, containing classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at area code 780-450-3730, by fax at area code 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, T6L3T5. If you do not have a web connection, please request a free printed catalogue.